We have a baby.
Yeah.
A very beautiful and peaceful, well-behaved baby, it would appear. Ben and Amanda from Portland, Maine, right? Thank you for being here. They were just down at Tassajara. We passed them actually on the road. And we were coming back from Mel's Ashes interment ceremony. We passed them on the Tassajara Road as they were going in, and you're just back from there, right? You had a good time? Wonderful. Yeah. And there's Sue. Sue is there. She's mobile and here in person. That's pretty thrilling. And we don't get to see Andrew and Paula that often, so they're here. The rest of you are just old hat, you know, we see them all the time. No big deal, but. And you, I don't think I know you. What's your name?
Matt.
Hi, Matt. Yeah, you sit in the morning, right? Or do you? Maybe I'm getting mixed up with somebody else. Anyway, welcome. Glad you're here. Yeah, so nice to see all of you. It was raining and chilly at the beach when I came down here, so it's kind of nice that it's so sunny here. Beautiful afternoon. So we're going to plunge into the sutra, but before that, I have a little comment to begin. And it has to do with the phrase that I think we noticed last time, Thomas Cleary's wonderful English phrase, the mundane whirl. Remember that? People thought that was pretty good. W-H-I-R-L, like a merry-go-round, the mundane whirl. And this, I think we can all appreciate this a lot these days. This is the spin we're all caught in. The spin that we loosely, without too much investigation, refer to as reality. Or the real world. Which is, as we know, a very troubled, fast-paced, entirely materialistic world of data and information and stuff going on all the time that is essentially based on difference and distinction and comparison and therefore ultimately on desire and pain. And this world really is a whir. And we really do get spun around in it. And we get very excited and stressed out. And we run around looking for ways to mitigate. And all the ways that we look for, sometimes including Buddhist practice, end up being additions to the catalog of woes in which we are spinning. Early Buddhism called this mundane whirl samsara and proposed that there could be an end to samsara through careful cultivation of a path that we could bring this to peace, nirvana, cessation. So nirvana was the end to the mundane whirl. Nirvana was nothing in and of itself, it was just the end to that. But then, sutras like the Avatamsaka Sutra and the Gandavyuha Sutra say, well, actually, nirvana is not nothing exactly in itself. In fact, propelled by the enormous passion of altruism and compassion, the desire that is natural to all living things to love and protect all beings without exception, which gives rise to the practice of omniscience, a boundless regard for the world and everything in it, nirvana then becomes a vast expanse of endless loveliness, a vast expanse of love, of wisdom, of joy. That, yes, does end the stress of the mundane world. But once that stress of the mundane world is put to rest, all this other stuff that was there the whole time suddenly springs into being. So you could say, one way to say it is that the whole of the Avatamsaka Sutra is an expression of what nirvana looks like. If it actually were there, this is what it would look like. So to be sure, the sutra is clear that this inspiring vision of reality is not objective or materialistic or true. The samsara is false, this is true. No, it's just like samsara, it's empty. It's an empty reality that has no substance. And it is non-different from samsara and nirvana. And yet, I hope we're finding that the heart responds to it with a lot of delight and a fullness and an inspiration that I feel when I read the sutra, and I hope you're feeling it too, if you're able to settle down and keep your mind. It's hard to keep your mind on it. Have you noticed that? The mind wants to glance off, but you have to just take some effort to stay with it. But if you do that and you enter into its world, it's very delightful and inspiring. And in the light of the sutra, it seems quite obvious that within the many world systems throughout space and time, anything and everything will rise and fall like the waves in the ocean. And there, of course, will be dark times and light times and tragic times and glorious times. But that in the end, everything is inevitably going toward peace and awakening, because the great vows of innumerable Buddhas stand behind all these worlds and guide them all to fruition, regardless of whatever shape they may be in at the moment. And all the darkness is only a temporary illusion to be endured so that we can perfect Shanti Paramita and then go forward toward awakening. So the great Mahayana vision expressed here in the Gandavyuha Sutra and the Avatamsaka Sutra and all the Mahayana Sutras, to me, is pretty much the same as this spiritual visions of all the world's great religions, which have their equivalents, although I have to say none quite as spectacular as this, but they have their equivalents. And so these traditions are all a source of great hope and always have been throughout human history. This is how people go on, right? They have a tremendous hope for the future, no matter how bleak things on this planet Earth, you know, among human beings, there have been a lot of very bleak times when it was hard to imagine how anybody could get out of bed. And they did, because they had hope. And none of these spiritual visions are saying, really, that this or that is going to happen in the near or in the distant future. But they are saying that right now, if we make the effort, now, we can find in our own hearts the pure land that we are hoping for. That it's actually here, right now, these worlds, right within us. And that our cultivation and compassion and our love and our letting go of our self-centered afflictive emotions right now makes the world a Buddha land. In its great emphasis on the vows of past Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and on the need and the desire to find them and venerate them and depend on all the spiritual benefactors that we're seeing Sudhana visiting. He keeps expressing over and over again how wonderful it is to visit spiritual benefactors, how important this is. In that theme of the sutra, we're being told that practice is not a matter of the psychological or moral efforts that we are making, but rather it's a matter of our confidence and faith in the essential goodness and awakening within our own hearts that is our birthright as human beings, a birthright that we share not only with every other human being we will ever meet, but with all living and non-living things. It's telling us that practice is not an accomplishment or achievement that we can do or succeed at or fail at. It's nothing like that at all. It's a joyful process that we engage in for our whole life. And that we do it, no matter what, with everybody and everything. Even if we're all by ourselves, we're never apart from everybody and everything. There's no other way to practice but with our spiritual benefactors side by side. That's the only way to practice. Anyway, I think I say that same thing every single week, I think, pretty much. But and every week I say, well, maybe this week I won't say that again. But then I say, no, I want to say it again one more time, so I'm saying it again. Maybe next time I won't say it anymore. Yeah, you keep coming back, but I know I count on the fact that you forget that I said it last time. now I'm going to the sutra. I want to just also say that Laura is going to post a rough, because it's confusing. You know, I have this text, and I'm not. It would be nice of me, wouldn't it, to go back to the text that you have online and align the pages there, page numbers there with the page number here, but I've been too lazy or occupied with other things to do that. So Laura has provided a chart on there. And basically, as I said in the very beginning, we're just going through the whole text, roughly about 30 to 40 pages a week till the end of October. So right now I'm reading on page 171, which means that that's roughly about 160 pages from the beginning of the sutra, whatever page number that's, it's 1,100 and something.
Laura has her chart here.
Yeah, she has the chart there.
It's
yeah.
It's posted to the event post.
Event post. Yeah.
So far just to today, but I'll add it to.
Yeah.
And
it lists all the 53 teachers, yeah. So thanks, Laura, that's great. I'm glad you have the patience to do that. That's a lot of work. Okay, so I'm overheard online before we started that Heidi was wondering how would I be able to pronounce these unpronounceable names. They're just made up of elements, familiar elements, but there's just a lot of them. So the way I do it is I have to break them up into elements, and then you can pronounce them, but not easily. You have to concentrate on each one. And I think I said last time or one of these times that this is a whole list of night goddesses. So we were a lot of the teachers that Sudhana was visiting were in various places, but now he's visiting a whole bunch of teachers who would appear to be night goddesses who are right there in the place where Buddha is awakened. So they're right there in the spot where Buddha is. But of course, we know that that spot is not a one-dimensional physical place on earth. It's a sort of a cosmic, multi-dimensional place in the universe where Buddha is awakened and is awakening every minute. All the time. So this night goddess that I'm beginning with is named Samanta Gabi Rashrivi Malaprabha. Pretty good, right? I practiced. Not that I could do that again, but I did it once, and that'll be enough. So he went to her. He paid his respects to her, and I'm reading on page 171. And he said to her, "Noble goddess, I have set my mind on supreme enlightenment, but I do not know how an enlightened an enlightening being acts in the stage of enlightening practice, or how one proceeds and how one perfects it. So the question is a little bit different, maybe you noticed. Instead of saying, I don't know what the teachings are and how to put them into practice, now he's saying specifically, I don't know how an enlightening being acts in the stage of enlightening practice. So this is a little bit more further, slightly further down the road, apparently. So she responds, it is good that, aspiring to enlightenment, you ask how to proceed and how to fully accomplish the stages of enlightening beings. By the fulfillment of 10 things is the practice of enlightening beings accomplished. And now we're going to hear these 10 things. Now, most of the time when there's 10 things, it's the 10 paramitas, and they've been repeated a number of times. But this list of 10 is slightly different. So let's listen carefully and see what this list of 10 things that you need to fulfill to do the practice of enlightening beings. First, by purification of attainment of concentration in which all Buddhas are seen face to face. That's the first one. And we'll hear more about face to face later on. So it's a concentration, it's meditation in which you actually see the Buddhas intimately, face to face. Second, by purification of the eye, viewing the infinite body of all Buddhas resplendent with marks of distinction. So if in the first one you see the Buddhas face to face, now you see the Buddha's body and its marks. Three, by entering into the manifestation of the infinite ocean of qualities of Buddhas. So face, body, and qualities. Fourth, by realizing the cosmic dimensions of the ocean of spheres of the infinite manifestations of the teaching of Buddhas. So you can see this is all different aspects of the Buddhas that you become very close to, and they don't seem, now we think of the Buddhas as like they're some at some remove, but in this case, you are completely there. There's nothing outside of you. All these things are your personal knowledge, just the way you know your own name, or you know the feeling of your body, or you recognize the person in the mirror in the same way you would recognize all of this. Fifth, by entering the emanation of multitude of beams of light, as many as beings, from the pores of all Buddhas, aiding the sentient beings in various ways. And light is a very important element of this sutra. Things are always flooded with light, and light, of course, as we know, is a kind of miraculous phenomenon. Nobody knows what it is exactly, light. It's uncanny in so many ways. And it is, there's no world without this world. I mean, imagine, no light. This world couldn't possibly, we wouldn't see it. We couldn't be in it. Nothing in it could live. Light is a strange and wonderful miracle. But it's also, I was reading, oddly, I don't ask why, but I was reading in the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci, who was like fascinated with light falling on objects, right? And how light falls on the drapery of a costume, you know, and all the different ways that light behaves and acts in relation to objects in the sun. So light, a really important element in the sutra. Six, by seeing oceans of flames. The flames, also fire, the colors of all jewels, flames the colors of all jewels coming from each pore. So light and flame. And seven, by penetrating the mystical manifestations of oceans of emanations of Buddhas pervading all universes and guiding sentient beings in each mental moment. So these Buddhas have various emanations, and they appear everywhere, and they are guiding every moment of experience in time. So that's the seventh thing that you would experience and know. Eighth, by penetrating the sounds of thunder of all the scriptures proclaimed in the past, present, and future cycles of teachings of the Buddhas, using the mystical languages of all sentient beings. So sound is also an important element. The sound that Avalokiteshvara hears, hearing sounds is a very intimate experience. One of the most wonderful practices is when you're sitting in Zazen, you know, you can listen to the sounds around you, and it's very beautiful. If we're lucky enough to be away from disturbing sounds, although I did a retreat over the weekend, and it was at a Jewish meditation retreat center on 6th Street in Berkeley. Usually a very quiet neighborhood, but we found out as we began the retreat that there was going to be a street fair on 6th Street that day. So while we were sitting, listening to the quiet, there was a Polish polka orchestra playing. It was really kind of fun. After you got over the idea that there's not supposed to be a Polish polka orchestra playing during a meditation retreat, it was actually quite delightful. There was a guy singing. It was really nice. So we just sat there and breathed and listened to the music. But in this case, you're not hearing polka music. You're hearing the sounds of the thunder of all the scriptures proclaimed in the past, present, and future cycles of teachings of the Buddha in all the myriad languages in which those sutras were taught. Ninth, by entry into the infinite ocean of Buddha names. So remember, there are whole pages of the sutra that were naming Buddhas, hundreds of names of Buddhas. So Buddha's names are a source of blessing. And finally, number 10, by penetrating the guidance of sentient beings by manifestation of inconceivable, miraculous transformations of Buddhas. By the attainment of these 10, enlightening beings become fully accomplished in enlightening practice. So, if you think about them, these 10 all have to do with being intimate with Buddhas and all their manifestations, being intimate with their qualities, with their teachings, all of which we learn at the end is for the purpose of helping sentient beings, transforming sentient beings, purifying and clarifying the whole world. Otherwise, there wouldn't be Buddhas. That's why there are Buddhas. That's the reason why Buddhas exist. Buddhas exist in order to meet the needs of this world. Then she says, I have attained the enlightening liberation called bliss of tranquil meditation, boldly going everywhere. Good, right? Sounds good. By this I see the Buddhas of past, present, and future and enter into their oceanic congregations, their oceanic projections by concentration, their oceanic efforts in the past, and oceans of their names. I also comprehend the differences of the teaching cycles of those Buddhas, the variety of their lifespans, the differences in their voices, and their embodiment of the infinite realm of reality. Yet, I do not become attached to those Buddhas in terms of states of being. Why? Because those Buddhas do not go, having stopped all worldly courses of action. They do not come because of the non-becoming of intrinsic nature. They are not present, being physically equal to the unoriginated nature of reality. They are not extinct, being characterized by non-origination. They are not real, because they convey the vision of phenomena as in illusion. And they are false, because of accomplishing the welfare of all beings. That's interesting, right? They are false because of accomplishing the welfare of all beings, because there is no problem with beings. And to take on the problem of beings and meet it would automatically be false, but you are false for compassionate reasons.
Is it not false? They are.
They are false. They are not real. They are false, it says here. Yeah, no, I like it that they're false.
I hear you.
Yeah. They do not pass from one condition to another because they are free from death and birth. They do not perish because of the imperishable nature of things. They are uniform because they are beyond all manner of speech. They are formless because of being done with the forms and natures of things. Therein, based on great compassion without any false conceptions, to focus my mind solely on carrying out the salvation of all beings, I cultivate the first stage of meditation. Now, this is going through the jhanic stages, you know, the four jhanic stages, which are described in the early sutras. But here, the jhanic stages are described with reference to bodhisattva practice. Every stage of meditation is performed and carried out for and with others, as you'll see. I cultivate the first stage of meditation to cease all mental action and focus my mind solely on joy and happiness in taking care of all sentient beings with the power of knowledge. I cultivate the second stage of meditation to realize the purity of inherent nature of all beings with equanimity. Detached from the mundane world, I cultivate the third stage of meditation, to extinguish the burning of the pain of afflictions of all sentient beings, I cultivate the fourth stage of meditation. So each one is not just equanimity for me and joy for me, but in relation to sentient beings. To extend the sphere of the vow for omniscience, for skill in producing the ocean of all concentrations, to enter the means of access to the ocean of liberation of all enlightening beings, to know the science of occult powers of all enlightening beings, to effect the mystic projection of practices of all enlightening beings, I cultivate the enlightening liberation that goes everywhere through tranquil meditation, purifying the knowledge that enters into every realm of reality. Furthermore, while I'm doing this, I also develop sentient beings to maturity by various means. In people engrossed in sex play, in the still of the night, I induce the thought of impurity, the thought of disappointment, the thought of weariness, the thought of trouble, the thought of bondage, the thought of bedevilment, the thought of impermanence, the thought of pain, the thought of selflessness, the thought of ownerlessness, the thought of offense, the thought of old age and death, and the thought of indifference to all objects of desire. That would certainly take the edge off of your sexual activity. And those people developing this state of mind, indifferent to all pleasures, coming to enjoy sensual pleasure, go forth from home to homelessness. So they immediately jump out of their bed with their partner and they all become monks and nuns. When they have gone into the forest and are following spiritual principles, I foster faith in them. I cause a lull in all disturbing, frightening, loud sounds. And in the quiet of the night, I reveal to them the profundity of the Buddha teaching. I provide them with circumstances conducive to effort, open the door of renunciation, show the path. Listen to that Buddha teaching out there. Wow, you can't do much better than that, right? Pretty much the same thing that it says here, right? Anyway, I provide them with circumstances conducive to effort, open the door of renunciation, show the path, provide light, dispel darkness, put a stop to fear, praise renunciation, speak of the qualities of the Buddha, the teaching, and the community, and of spiritual benefactors, and praise going to spiritual benefactors. So as I like to say, you wouldn't necessarily get this from this passage, but I think that while spiritual practice mostly appears to be the opposite of living in the sensual world, you know, don't eat so much, don't be involved in sexual activity, it's very bad for you, and so on and so on. Which makes it sound as if spiritual practice is not fun, right? Not edifying or pleasurable. But I think that one of the things the sutra is expressing is how pleasurable and how wonderful is the spiritual life, because it is a kind of refined enjoyment that is full of equanimity and doesn't have the qualities of pain that are often associated with the sensual life. You know, there's a moment of pleasure, but there's always, like one of my, I used to always say, you know, you think an ice cream cone is delicious, and it is, but now I'm forcing you to eat 10 ice cream cones in a row. Tell me how much you like the 10th one. And the answer is not that much. You know, so there's a quality of problem to sensual world, whereas in the spiritual life doesn't have that problem, and there's a great pleasure. I think the spiritual path is full of imagination and pleasure and interest. So, I don't think you necessarily get that from this passage, but he is talking about the spiritual pleasure. They come to enjoy spiritual pleasure when they go forth from home to homelessness. Okay, I'm skipping now a few, and I'm going, I think this is, now each one of these night goddesses has a whole backstory, so that their stories are quite long. But I'm going to the next one, and I'm going to read in this text on page 176, just a few pages from that place. This is the night goddess Pramudita Nayana Jagad Vairochana. That's her name. And notice that it has the word Vairochana in it. And Vairochana is the sort of prevailing Buddha of this part of the sutra. And Vairochana Buddha is the sort of cosmic Buddha. But there, I think I will read a passage a little later on where Vairochana is conflated with Shakyamuni in this sutra. You know, it's not clear that Shakyamuni is an other Buddha besides Vairochana Buddha. Vairochana Buddha becomes Shakyamuni Buddha, and Shakyamuni becomes Vairochana. Yay! Cheerful fellow, right? Seems to be kind of happy. I mean, who wouldn't be happy, right? If you have a mother and a father that you 100% sure will absolutely take care of everything all the time. Like, it's not a question, right? You're sure. And everything is new and fresh and beautiful. I mean, who's not going to be happy, right? Wonderful. Yeah, there's a passage here that reminds me of that if we ever get to it. I don't know where it is, but anyway. Yeah, so I'll read on page 176. This next night goddess, he visits her and sees, you know, when he sees these different benefactors, he sees the whole scene in which they're embedded. And so this is a passage where he's looking at what's going on all around her. He saw multitudes of projected bodies in the forms of all sentient beings emerge from every pore of the goddess. So close your eyes and imagine a beautiful goddess sitting there with infinite sentient beings pouring out of every pore in her body. Just can you picture that? There's no space in the picture because there's only bodies of sentient beings surrounding this goddess infinitely in all directions. Appearing before all sentient beings in all worlds, showing them unshakability in all aspects of self-control, illustrating as many forms of austerity as there are living beings, showing independence from all worlds, disregard of all objects, indifference to all mundane abodes, showing that celestial and human prosperity and decline, happiness and suffering are all inextricably intertwined. That's true, right? But when you're in the middle of everything is going well, you don't think that, do you? I often think that. I often think like, okay, when is the other shoe gonna drop, right? But that might be because of my childhood conditioning more than my practice in Buddhism. But anyway, but it's true. When things are going well, it means that later they won't. When things are going badly, it means that later they'll improve, right? Because it goes round and round and round. Showing impurity and putting an end to the false notion of purity in the world. Revealing the nature of things as impermanent, unstable, and changing. Showing the nature of all conditioned states as painful and selfless. Promoting the appeal of living constantly in the realm of the enlightened, directing sentient beings to the ultimate purity of the way of life of the enlightened, teaching the practice of discipline using expressions adapted to the mentalities of all sentient beings, showing the grace of ethical conduct, pleasing all sentient beings, developing all sentient beings to maturity. Isn't that a wonderful thought, the grace of ethical conduct? You don't usually think of gracefulness and ethical conduct as being the same thing, but when you think about it, wouldn't that be so? I mean, in Buddhism, ethical conduct is understood to be the spontaneous, beautiful conduct of Buddhas. And so Buddhas are inherently graceful and beautiful. That's why in all these descriptions of the Buddha, they're always described as being, you know, having glowing and being beautiful and in every way and so on and so on. Because to live an ethical life of purity and loving kindness in relation to the whole world is a very graceful and beautiful way to live. Okay, now I'm skipping to another goddess I'm now on page 188 in my text. And this is Samantasattva Rajojashri. Samantasattva Rajojashri. Another night goddess. He saw the night goddess Samantasattva Tranojashri in all realms of being in those worlds, facing every sentient being capable of being guided by seeing all worlds together at once. He saw her standing without division before all sentient beings, adapting to their lifespans, their various spheres of belief, their physical forms, their conventions of verbal communication, and their mastery in order to guide them to full development. That is to say, he saw her standing before all sentient beings without division to free beings in hells from the pains and fears of hells, to free beings in brutish states from the perils of mutual predation, to free beings in the realm of ghosts from the pains and perils of hunger and thirst, to free beings in the realm of dragons from all the pains and perils of the dragon realm, to free all beings in the realm of desire from all the pains and perils of the realm of desire, to free all beings in the human realm from all the fears and perils of darkness, to free beings from all fear of ill repute, to free beings from intimidation by groups. They think of these things, right? To free beings from fear of death, to free beings from fear of falling into states of misery, to free beings from fear of not being able to make a living. Big fear, right? I think economic peril, which is so many people have, is a very terrible misery state. To free beings from fear of loss of virtue, to free beings from fear of loss of the determination for enlightenment, to free beings from the danger of association with bad companions, to free beings from fear of separation from spiritual benefactors. That is, he saw her confronting the purification of all lands by undertaking the vow to save all beings. He then stood before her and spoke verses for her, which go on for several pages. And then he says to her, and this is how the backstory comes to be, he says to her, and he did not say this to any of the other spiritual benefactors, but now with the night goddesses, he's now saying, how long ago did you attain this concentration that we've been describing? How long ago did you attain it? And then she tells him a long story, and the other goddesses do too, about in past lives, who she was, the whole situation of what occurred in past lives. And you get the whole story and you're lost in the story. You forget that who you were even talking about. And then at the end she says, well, I was that, you know, that daughter in the story, that was me in a past life. You know that queen in the story? That was me in a past life. Anyway, in the course of the story, she's now setting the scene for this story of her past lives. And she says on page 193 here, at that time, the lifespan of the beings in that world was measureless. There were none with fixed lifespans and no untimely deaths. So this was quite a world. Also at that time, the variety of forms of sentient beings was known, as was the variety of their colors, voices, names, families, lifespans, physical sizes, abilities and strengths, agreeable and unpleasant affairs, and higher and lower inclinations. In that world, those with better appearances and more confidence, who were physically perfect and good-looking, proclaimed their superiority to others. And those with well-formed bodies looked down on those with ill-formed bodies. Well, that doesn't sound like a very good thing, does it? No. And then, because of the evil of mutual contempt, they lost their span of life, their physical appearance, their strength and happiness, and all was lost. So, that tells you, this world that we live in now might be that world. It might be that in this world, we all used to live, like when you read the Bible and they say that people live to be 900 years old and all that, maybe it's true. We all live to be 900, 800, 700 years old. But because of mutual contempt, which we are enacting now to a tremendous degree, we fell from grace and we are now in this sort of like semi-miserable state. Not us, of course, but the other people are in a miserable state. And that's how it happened, because of mutual contempt. So that's the worst thing. You know, don't have any contempt for anybody, especially yourself, which is very easy to do, have contempt for yourself. However, all is not lost, of course, because there was an enlightenment tree there called Sound of the Clouds of Teaching Illuminating All. And in front of that enlightenment site, there was a pond of fragrant water, and in the middle of that pond, there was a great ruby lotus called a ray of clouds of light rays, flashing lightning from between the leaves, illuminating the sphere of the Buddhas of past, present, and future. That was the name of the lotus. All capitals. And on top of that lotus, and so on, and so on, and so on. Having thus developed beings for 10,000 years by means of such measureless lights, because the Buddha sitting on that lotus was projecting lights, when the 7 days were up, he shook that whole world with infinite means of shaking it and made it completely pure. So even though they had, gone to a very sorry state, that was not the end of the story, because there's always another Buddha around the corner who's going to come and do this for you. As in those final 7 days, all the beings in that world who were ripe for the sight of Buddha stood facing the sight of enlightenment. And so forth. Okay. And then one more little piece. And this is the, I told you that I would, oh, there's a, let me see if I find, oh, here. Here's the part I want to, reminded the baby, the baby's cooing reminded me of this. This is still part of her backstory of her past lives. When she heard these scriptures, 10,000 kinds of concentrations entered into her. Subtle and pleasant. So this is what I mean about the pleasures of the spiritual life. You know, when you sit there in zazen and the body is at ease and the mind is peaceful, this is a great thing. And the light is soft and the birds are singing. It's beautiful. So she entered into that subtle and pleasant concentration, like the consciousness of an embryo on the first day in the mother's womb, like the commencement of activity in beings, like the impulse of the sprout in the seed of a tree on the day it is planted. This is how subtle and full of potential these concentrations were. 10,000 concentrations descended into her, beginning with such concentration as one called face-to-face communication with all Buddhas. So we heard about that earlier, and now it's mentioned here again. And I just think this is, there's something very profound about this. You know, moment, right, where something crosses over from not being a living being to the first stirrings of awakeness. And this is an unthinkable, we can't even imagine, but it makes it sound like such a, as it says here, subtle and pleasant. The life, the arising of life, which is such a strange thing, you know, what is life exactly? Is so subtle and pleasant. And that is, brings that, that's, in other words, that subtle and pleasant dawning, the first blush, you know, of life itself, before we've had a chance to sort of mess it up and kick it around and complain about it. Just that first blush is so profoundly moving that it leads to the concentration of face-to-face with the Buddhas. And the reason I'm interested in that is because I've always been studying Dogen's fascicle called Face-to-Face Transmission, in which he speaks about against the grain of other people at the time who tended to emphasize the spiritual dimension of the practice rather than the human dimension. And they would say, you can receive transmission from Manjushri Bodhisattva, you can receive transmission from famous teachers who died many generations ago. Dogen said, no. The kind of transmission that we practice in our way of Zen is face-to-face transmission. It has to be another human being, and there's a face-to-face meeting. And then when he starts talking about what is a face and what is face-to-face meeting, it really gets very profound and very beautiful, because it's not at all obvious. You know, when I say it, it sounds like, oh yeah, a person and a person. And he does mean a person and a person, a living person and a living person, not online, but face-to-face in actual air between them and everything. But then when he starts talking about what that is, it becomes very, very beautiful and profound. And I think it is the sort of foundation of what we mean in our tradition by, you know, practicing together, hand to hand, face to face, body to body, mind to mind. It's very, very beautiful and hard to describe. Someday we'll have to study that fascicle. Anyway, so I end there, and Laura told me that there were no, I would have said a lot less, but there were no people who said they were going to read tonight. But if there is someone who wants to read a page of the sutra who didn't sign up, I open the space for that if you have the text with you and would like to read. Well, that's okay. I didn't think there would be anyone. So I'm happy to have a little bit of time, because I would like to have us have a little more time tonight in groups. And before we do the groups, let me just, a couple of practical things, and then we'll do groups. First thing is that next week is October the 1st, and Jean is going to take care of the seminar next week. It will be online only. I'll be back in 2 weeks. But I hope to see many of you before then, on October 4th, when we're sitting at Green Gulch. The reason that I am not able to be here on next Wednesday is because next Wednesday is Yom Kippur. And actually, it's a little, not exactly, Yom Kippur is actually on Thursday, but the Jewish days start in the night. You'd think that the day would start at dawn, but no. It starts at sundown. So that's why I have to go to the synagogue and observe the holiday and fast as I do every year, so that I can atone for my many, many sins and hope for a better year. It's odd, I should just note, that since we're talking about this Mahayana Sutra with so many vows, so all turns on vows, the whole Kol Nidre service is a very solemn service in which all the vows that you have made in the previous year are officially nullified. Yeah?
Also the vows that you're going to make.
And the vows you're going to make, right? All nullified. So that tells you that in Judaism, the idea of vowing is a totally different idea. Because in this case, the horror would be that you vow something and you didn't accomplish it. And in Mahayana Buddhism, it's the opposite. You vow only that which you could not possibly accomplish. That would take infinite lives to accomplish. That's what you vow. But Judaism doesn't have that idea. So they always say in the beginning of Yom Kippur, okay, to start this whole process of atonement, we're going to take back all our vows. So it's a long story, but the spiritual visions of Judaism and Buddhism in many ways are pretty much the opposite of each other. And yet at the same time, they quite converge. It's quite odd. Anyway, that's why I won't be here next Wednesday evening, and I'll be in the synagogue praying fervently the next day and starving. So one of the things I brought up tonight was the idea of serving spiritual benefactors, and saying that in the sutra, I think what that really is telling us is that the only way that we practice is together with everything. and that this is not about our accomplishment or the things that we're going to do and how we're going to do them. It's really about our entering into communion with everything and everyone. That's what the practice is about. And that's, I mean, much of Buddhism is often presented as, you know, here's the path, you should accomplish it. If you walk the path and accomplish the path, the reward is nirvana. And this is not, this is saying something quite different. So I put that to you as something to think about in terms of your own practice. How does that compute for you? How does that strike you? And how do you relate to it in terms of your own practice? So everybody, So I'm sort of proposing two takes on what practice could be. I'm saying that I think the sutra is telling us that practice is not something that we can accomplish and that we can do. It really is a matter of our entering into communion with everything. That's what our practice is, entering into communion with everything. And together with everything, we all awaken. Versus, practice is a psychological, spiritual process that an individual engages, improves, receives, you know, ends up, we hope, with a good result and a goal of awakening, nirvana, relief. And so those are two different, I mean, I think certainly Mahayana Buddhism would propose that those are the same thing. But how about you? How does that strike you in your practice? What does that evoke in you in terms of your own literal practice and spiritual process? So think about that together. Okay?